My name is Inderjit Bogle. I was ordained in 1980 in Sheffield, as it happens, and ministry has taken me to Wolverhampton, where I was for 8 years, and then I came back to Sheffield in 1987, and I've been minister here ever since. In that time, I've held roles in circuits as chaplain and the two universities, but also director of the Urban Theology Unit, where I served for 10 years. And after my time at the Urban Theology Unit, I was a theologian for Christian Aid. Then I worked with the Yorkshire and Humber Faiths Forum, which I helped to establish. And then I went to be the leader and chief executive of Corrymeela Community in Northern Ireland. And I've served in the Methodist Learning Network. I'm now a retired Methodist minister.
So your upbringing, was Christian and Christianity part of your life always?
I was born into a very deeply religious Sikh family. I was born in Nairobi in East Africa. How did that happen? What was I doing in, what were my parents doing in Nairobi? Well, to tell you the story, they lived in Punjab in northwest of India. In 1947, India achieved independence from Britain. And that period of independence and what was called partition of India and Pakistan led to one of the greatest movement of people across borders. So some Indians were going into Pakistan, some were going towards India and so on. 12 million people, crossing each other across the borders. And it was a time of conflict, a lot of violence. And my parents will have been young teenagers. And I can imagine their parents saying to them, you have to get out of here. Go and find a life for yourself, safe and fulfilling elsewhere. So they went to East Africa, and my father worked in the British East African Railways and Harbours Company there, and that's where I was born. And we lived in Nairobi until Kenya became independent in 1964, and then we had to leave. And anybody who's born in Britain, in one of the British colonies after the 1st of January 1945, automatically had British citizenship. So we had British passports. So we had to get out of Kenya. And so via a 9-month sojourn in Tanzania, or Tanganyika as it was, we came to Britain and to our home in Dudley in the West Midlands. So yeah, Sikh family. And in Nairobi, our house was always very close to the Sikh temple, the Gurdwara. I spent a lot of time in the temple. It was my playground. It was my learning place, my place of worship. I had food there and so on. And I went to a Sikh school in Nairobi. So I was deeply immersed in the Sikh faith. Well familiar with the Sikh faith. When we came to live in Britain, there was actually only 2 Sikh temples in the whole of Britain at that time. But because we didn't have a temple near us, and I was still quite young, and I was used to going to the nearest place of worship, I started going to the nearest place of worship. As it happened, it was a Methodist chapel. It was a place where God was honoured and worshipped, and that's all I wanted to do. So that's where I went. I got more and more drawn into the story of Christ as I read the New Testament, and gradually really moved into being a follower of Christ. As I began to talk about Christ, some people said, you should be a preacher. So I became a local preacher and candidated then for the Methodist ministry. And I was ordained in 1980. In Sheffield, as I said.
What a story. And when you first came to Britain, to Dudley, what was your experience like?
When we came to live in Dudley, I'm talking about early 60s now, it was not a pleasant experience. It was very different, the appearance of England, to what my image was when I lived in Africa of England. And at school, it was not easy because I used to wear a turban at the time, and for a while I was the only person in Dudley with the turban, which was mocked and made fun of, and some of my English classmates, if they just thought I was dirty, this was dirt, you know, if they rubbed shoulders against me, they felt that become defiled, polluted, and would wipe themselves. They'd wipe a chair before they sat on it, if I'd been sitting on it. So it was not pleasant. This was a new experience for me, that kind of prejudice. I'd never experienced it when I was in Kenya. So when I started going to the local Methodist church, which, you know, within a few days of arriving here, I actually received a very good welcome in the church, and that contrasted with what was happening in school. So while I was feeling very marginalized in school, in church I was valued and welcomed. And I think that that is quite important, because if I hadn't been welcomed in church, I wouldn't be sitting here today with my history of life in the Methodist church. There's the stories of Jesus Christ eating with people, spending most of his time with the most marginalized. You know, when people wanted to be critical of him, they said he eats with the sinners and tax collectors and so on. The kind of the most ostracized people of his day. And that made sense to me. But also, following on from that, Holy Communion, you know, in my understanding, the only liturgical instruction Jesus gave was, whenever you meet in my name, have some food and remember me. And that connected with the Sikh practice of langar, the common communal kitchen where everyone is welcome to eat. And I thought, well, you know, that those things kind of rang bells for me. The most repeated ethical requirement and command in the Bible is, you shall also love the stranger. Now, because that's stated so frequently in the Bible, I feel that that ought to be a loud and clear message of the church, and it should give direction to what it is to be church, you know, to also love the stranger, to look at who are the people who feel most on the outside, the most as a stranger and not welcome, and what can you do to make them feel included and given a good welcome and value.
Is that what inspired your interfaith group work, or was that something else?
No, I mean, I've been interfaith in my being for a long time. You know, I'm a follower of Christ. My roots are in the Sikh faith. And I'm conscious that the original, earliest followers of Christ, his apostles, were Hebrews. You know, they followed him as Jews. And Paul was proud of his Hebrew roots. He didn't feel he had to change that in order to be a follower of Christ. So I've been a follower of Christ within my Sikh tradition.
Absolutely, definitely. And a few things I want to pick up from there. The power of walks. I think something you like to do a lot is walk, and a lot of your activism has been through walking and bringing communities together through walking. Is there a particular reason why walking is what you do?
Oh, Jesus was a great walker. I mean, obviously he walked everywhere, and somebody has worked out that apparently he walked about 5 miles a day. You know, which is not a bad kind of distance. So I have a car, but I don't use it a lot. I walk, and I reckon each day I walk about 5 miles. So it's a kind of regular part of my life. When I was working in Wolverhampton and with the interfaith group in Wolverhampton, that one of the things we could do is to connect different faiths. There's one road in Wolverhampton, for example, Lee Road, and all the different faith communities you can think of, they all had a little temple or mosque or mandir there. And so regularly we used to just walk along that street and visit each other's place of worship as a way of connecting, praying with each other and building relationships. And so when I came to Sheffield, I did the same. And in Belfast, in Northern Ireland, I organised interfaith walks like that. And some years ago, a group of people detained in a immigration detention centre went on a hunger strike to draw attention to their plight. So I wrote a letter to the Prime Minister asking for a fairer deal for asylum seekers. And instead of posting the letter, I decided to hand deliver it. So I walked from my home in Sheffield to number 10 Downing Street and walked during the period of Lent. This is 1997. It took me 20 days or so to walk 200 miles or so and all the way along to talk about the issues and engage with the media to raise the concerns, and it was very effective, I thought, you know. So people I admire and respect, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Jesus Christ, Guru Nanak, the founder of the Sikh faith, they were all great walkers. I feel that I'm following the example of my mentors, if you like, those who inspire me.
Thinking about, you know, more recent work, you founded the City of Sanctuary Movement. Please could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I've lived in Sheffield for a long time, and it's a city that's been welcoming people from many parts of the world for many years. I think partly because of its industrial history. And I was conscious that there were many organisations working with refugees, particularly in the city. And so I supported them. But one day I decided to convene a meeting of all the organisations working in Sheffield with refugees. And we met in the Methodist Church, and they all talked about their work, which was wonderful, and we applauded. Then I said to them, I think if you all work together, you're all doing great work, but if you work together, if you could all collaborate, we could make a big difference in shifting the whole culture of our city to build here cultures of welcome and hospitality and safety for everyone, especially the most vulnerable. Where God says to Moses, set up 6 cities of refuge so that people may go there and find safety. So this is from the days when the ethics was around an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, which was a way of limiting violence, proportionality, only an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, no more. But there were always those who wanted to go further. If you took, if you hit them or accidentally cause them harm, they'd want to kill you. Revenge, take revenge in that way. So God was really saying, set up these cities of refuge so that while their case is being processed, if people have been guilty of some crime, while their case is being processed, they might be safe. Not to avoid the law or to evade the law, but to be safe while their case is processed. I said we could have cities of refuge in Britain, and let's call it cities of sanctuary. But cities of sanctuary will be places where people who are here amongst us as refugees, as people seeking sanctuary, we will make sure that while their cases are processed, while they are living amongst us, they feel welcome and have hospitality and are safe. And if we could all work together to do that and encourage others to do that, and if you could persuade our local authority, local government, to support us as well, we would become a city of sanctuary. That's what it means to be a city of refuge today. And they all agreed with me, and so we committed ourselves to that. That was the year 2005, and I said it'll take us 10 years to achieve our goal. But within 2 years, the Lord Mayor of Sheffield had declared Sheffield a city of sanctuary. We'd got so much support in our city. To be declared a city of sanctuary didn't mean we've arrived, everything is fine here, everybody's safe. I mean, no, that's it, not the case. What it does mean is that we've reached a marker, a point in our city where hundreds, thousands of people are working together to change the culture here, to build a culture of welcome and hospitality and safety, to build the kind of city we would be proud to live in. That's what it meant. So we'd got this city of sanctuary recognition in Sheffield, and then other people in other cities began to say, how did you do this? We'd like to do the same in our city.